So before we start, I just wanted to dedicate this for a Refuah Shlema for Rivka Chana Bas Tzipora. Shav a Refuah Shlema. It's my wife's aunt. So we are in the 21st day of the Omer, and we have a full 49 days in total that we count. 7 weeks, 7 days, times seven times seven. And in the process of the Sfira, we also hit a day 33, Lag BaOmer. That is a momentous day. We'll talk about Rosh Hashanah Bar Yochai. But what happened during... Let's do a little history here. So the Jews come out of Egypt, and we were commanded that as we leave Egypt, the next day, we start counting. And this is not a one-time event, but every year, an annual counting, that from the second day of Pesach, the day after the first day, we start counting in the process of getting towards receiving the Torah at Sinai on the 50th day. So this became the time of Sirah, time of preparation, time of leaving Egypt, right? So like we left, but it was like overwhelming experience that first day of leaving, that we really were not prepared for anything as being, you know, you need a process of getting out of slavery. 49 days is probably not even enough, right?
Let me ask a quick question.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did the Jews know they were going to receive Torah in 49 days' time?
They knew they were going to be going towards Sinai and I guess receiving Torah, yeah.
They knew something.
They were aware of something. Okay. Yeah, it's a good question. Like, exactly what were they expecting? I don't know. It's a good question. You know, so definitely Moses knew from the beginning of this whole process when he was at the burning bush at the Sneh. So it says that he was actually at the place he was actually on Mount Sinai, that the burning bush episode occurs on Mount Sinai, and in that discussion that he has with God there, God says to him, "You'll know that I sent you, or the people will know that I sent you, because you're going to come back to this place and you're going to worship me here." So Was Torah ever mentioned? You know, that's a good question. Like, meaning, how do you go from, you know, there was this like move from, a shift of sorts, going from this idea of we're going to go worship God in the desert, to that translating into receiving the Torah at Sinai. So it's an interesting idea as to like how that play is. But when we start looking at Torah and understanding what it's about, so we understand it as being like a transmission of God himself to us. So then it morphs into you have all these laws and commandments and things of that nature that guide us, but it's really ultimately supposed to be our ability to connect to God. And so that's like, the idea of coming to Mount Sinai was to be, quote unquote, Oved Hashem, to worship God, to, you know, work towards that relationship of connection. So fine. So in this process, so over time, we continuously come back. It's like we go through the cycle on a yearly basis of re-experiencing coming out of Egypt and then starting this process of getting ready for Mount Sinai, for the revelation, for Shavuot. And it became a time. So later on, what occurs in history is that you have Rabbi Akiva and his students who he ends up amassing a very large amount of students. And during this period of time, his 24,000 students perish. They die. Different theories as to what exactly they died from. And this is at around the time of the destruction of the temple and the second temple. And so this became a period of not just getting ready for receiving the Torah or getting out of Egypt, the continuation of that process, but now it also takes on a different dimension. It takes on this dimension of mourning, right? We had this incredible, I mean, you're talking 24,000 students and their caliber, they're on such a high caliber. Rabbi Kiva ends up becoming, I mean, he is the, he in a sense represents the oral tradition as we know it. And so you can imagine his whole institution that he built was destroyed in this period of time. So it becomes a very, in a certain sense, it takes on a there's a certain sadness, a morose or certain seriousness that we feel because of that loss. And then ultimately, Rabbi Kiva picks up and rebuilds, and he has five students. And those five students become the ones who are responsible for what we have today in terms of our Torah, our oral tradition. Just as a side, very interesting, we just learned Shkalim in Yerushalmi, and it basically it's part of the Daf Yomi cycle, which is kind of bizarre. What I mean by that is that normally when in the Talmud, when we are studying Daf Yomi, the daily page of Talmud, we're learning the Babylonian Talmud. And then for some reason in the cycle, they inserted one tractate from the Jerusalem Talmud. Completely different style. It's completely different style. So there's a Jerusalem Talmud. It has a very different structure. Just everything is different about it. So for those who are used to like studying the Babylonian Talmud, which is what we're going to learn, we're going to study today together, and which usually study together when we say quote unquote Talmud. Here you have the Jerusalem Talmud as it got into the printer, associated the tractate of Shkalim in with the rest of the Babylonian Talmud. So it becomes part of this this study process. The 7.5 year cycle has now one of the tractates. It's like an outlier is Shkalim, and the shekel is the half shekel. God said you have to bring the half shekel. We do it around the month of Adar. It's supposed to go to the temple. They would use that half shekel as the money towards buying the sacrifices for the year. They would, so that it was also used as a way to count the people, as doing a census at a certain point. Fine. Now, in this tractate, it talks about the fact that if you were to ask me and stop me and say, hey, who wrote the Mishnah? Say, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. But the truth is that the tractate in Shkalim explains that it's Rabbi Kiva who was responsible for the putting together the oral tradition in writing, and that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was an editor later on, but that the person who was responsible in his school, so to speak, that's responsible for what we have as Mishnah and all those, you know, the offshoots of that, all are really coming from Rabbi Akiva and his students, which is a little bit earlier. So you can imagine, so like when I say it that way, and then we say that he lost his 24,000 students during this period of time, it was earth-shattering. It really it shook the foundations of our tradition, and then he was able to stand up and rebuild, which is an amazing thing for someone to have lost that much, and then to turn around and be able to get back up and start again, is really remarkable. They say if you look at Rabbi Akiva's life, it was three periods of 40. He was 40 years old. He really had no background, or maybe it's questionable how strong his background was, but starts at the age of 40, and then he goes and becomes who we know him as, Rabbi Kiva, over the next 40 years. And then he lives till 120, and he has another 40 years. Perhaps it's he masses the students up to 80, and then rebuilds another 40 years. And then unfortunately, he was killed by the Romans in a very horrific way. So now that lifespan of 40 is very similar to Moses, to Moshe Rabbeinu. Moses was 40 years old when he ran away to Midian, and then for 40 years he's outside of Egypt, and comes back at the age of 80 to redeem the Jewish people. And then he's with the Jewish people for 40 years, basically, from taking us out of Egypt and in the desert. And he passes away at the end of his, at 120. So there's, they like to say that there's a parallel between Rabbi Akiva's life and that of Moses, of Moshe. Okay. So now, all of this is a background to this Gemara that we're going to look at now, and that Rabbi Akiva ended up having these five students after everything fell apart. And of those five students, so one of those students was Rabbi Shimon, who we know as Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. When we learn in the Talmud that there's a disagreement between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Shimon of the Mishnah that we see many, many times is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And then Rabbi Yehuda, we see that they have many of these very interesting discussions or disagreements throughout throughout the Gemara. So it's, and really it's the Mishnah, and then we expand in the Gemara. We see what we discuss these things. Like for example, this is one classic example when it comes to laws of Shabbos. So we have this idea that if you do something, davar she'enu miskaven. I'm doing something. The classic example is I take my bench and I drag it. I want to take it from point A to point B, and I drag it in my yard. And in the process of dragging the bench, I accidentally or I unintentionally made a furrow, right? Because I dragged it along. So the question is, and that's not, you're not allowed to do that on Shabbos, but that was not my intent. My intent was to bring my bench from point A to point B. So davar she'enu miskaven. Are you responsible for something that you didn't intend to make this ditch or this whatever you did in the ground there? So how do we understand that? Is that a problem or not? So the question is, how do we approach those things? So let's say, for example, this is an important fact, or important part of factor is that if we know for sure that you're going to do that. So then we call that a psik resha. So that's something that you know for sure is going to happen. That's a little different story. But let's say there's a 50-50 chance that you're going to end up making this plow. You're going to plow this ditch here when you pull your bench from point A to point B. So it's not like it's not 100% that it was going to happen. Psik resha means 100% that's going to end up happening. That's a different story. But let's say it's not a clear-cut thing that you're going to end up inadvertently making this thing. So now, what do we say? So Rabbi Shimon says that davar she'enu miskaven, meaning something that I didn't intend to do, I wasn't intent on doing that, you're pater. You're not liable. Rabbi Yehuda says you are, okay? So now the reason I give you that background is because now we're going to look at this Gemara here in Shabbos on Daf 30, on Lamed Gimel 33b, okay? And it talks about Rabbi Shimon. We can get to see Rabbi Shimon and what happens with him. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because, again, and the reason it's easy for me to remember this page is because it's talking about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and we have a very strong association to him on Lag BaOmer, on the 33rd day of the Omer. So, right, 33, and I look at page 33 in Shabbos, right? So easy way for me to remember. But two things happen. One is the students stop dying on the 33rd of the Omer. And number two is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, it says he introduced into the world the Zohar, the Kabbalah. Okay, so that he revealed that in a very strong way. And then he also passes away on the 33rd day of Omer. Now, what's interesting is, just as, again, another little parenthetical or little side note here, is that today in Israel, on the 33rd day of the Omer, Lag BaOmer, there is a massive amount of people that go up north to a place called Meron, where we were, when we went on our trip, we went up there to go to the mikveh, right? We're in Tzfat, we go to the mikveh there. That mikvah is the Arizal's mikvah, right? But nearby, and the mountain over, is a place called Meron, and that's where Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is buried. Guess what happens on the 33rd day of the Omer? On Lag BaOmer, his yard site, hundreds of thousands of Jews go. It's amazing. So if you go on YouTube and you put in Lag BaOmer in Meron, you'll see videos of thousands of Jews around bonfires, because the idea of the symbolism of the Botzina is the idea of this incredible amount of illumination, of fire, of light that was brought into the world by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And so they, what is it?
Botzina? What was
But
that word?
Botzina is a, it's an Aramaic word. It's like the idea of, Botzina is like the idea of illumination. Like I'm saying it as a fire, a big fire, but the idea of a big, a burst of light. Okay, Botzina dinahora. It's like a, it's an idea. It's a, I'm using, it's not an English word. That's a, I guess it's a Hebrew slash Aramaic. So, it's this great amount, this is incredible illumination that's brought into the world. And so that's what happens is that on Lag BaOmer, you have this, it, last year it didn't happen, but in pri it went because of Corona, but I think this year they're gonna, it's gonna happen. The country's open, so you're gonna have, the way they celebrate is they go up there, and it's a it's I never went, my son went, my sons have gone, and I've seen videos. It's amazing. Okay, so and all because they're really commemorating the life of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So let's see the Gemara's story here. Okay, so in the context of the Gemara is talking about Lashon Hara, and then it talks about. So let's see if this. A dilemma was raised before those who were sitting in the study hall. Did Rabbi Lezer, the son of Rabbi Yossi, say that a sakra, which is kind of some kind of a disease, comes as a which ends up killing people? So now to say this, a sakra say that a sakra comes as punishment only for slander, or perhaps he said it was also for slander. Come in here. A resolution for his dilemma, for that which was taught in the Braita. When our sages entered the vineyard in Yavne, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon were there, and a question was asked before them with regard to this plague of a sakra. Why does it begin in the intestines and end in the mouth? Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Rabbi Eloi, who was head of the speakers in every place, responded and said, "Even though the kidneys advise and the heart understands, and the tongue shapes the voice that emerges from the mouth, still the mouth completes the formation of the voice. Therefore, the disease begins in the same place that slander begins, and it ends in the mouth." Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Yossi, responded and said, "This disease ends in the mouth because one eats it with it non-kosher things." They immediately wondered about this. Does it enter your mind to say that a sakra is caused by eating non-kosher food? Are those who eat non-kosher food so numerous? Rather, it comes as a punishment for eating foods that are not ritually prepared, i.e., we're not tithed. Huh. Right? Eating things that are not tithed, right, Hugh? So
Exactly.
we're studying the laws of tithing. So we've done a lot on that. So this is the stakes are high when it comes to that. So Rabbi Shimon responded and said, "This disease comes as a punishment for the sin of dereliction in the study of Torah." Okay. So now, and again, this is all just want to give you a little bit of context here. As here they're having these discussions, and okay. So, all right. So let's continue on here. I'm not going to skip. I'm going to go straight. We're going to plow through this. So they said to him, "Women will prove that dereliction in study of Torah is not the case, as they are not obligated to study Torah, and nevertheless they contract the sakra." He answered them, "They are punished because they caused their husbands to be idle from the study of Torah." They said to him, "Gentiles will prove that this is not the cause, as they also contract the sakra, even though they are not obligated in the study of Torah." He answered them, "They are also punished because they caused Israel to be idle from the study of Torah." They said to him, "Children will prove that this is not the cause, for they are not at all obligated to study Torah, and they also suffer from a sakra." He answered them, "They are punished because they caused their fathers to idle from the study of Torah." They said to him, "School children will prove that this is not the cause, as they study Torah, nevertheless they suffer from a sakra." So again, so they're trying to figure out it's a sakra, the cause of a sakra. Rabbi Shimon, our Rabbi Shimon, said that the issue of it's all coming down to the issue of dereliction of in the study of Torah. Okay? Now, the Gemara answers there. It must be understood in accordance with the statement of Rabbi Gurion. As Rabbi Gurion said, and some say that it was Rabbi Yosef, son of Rabbi Shemaya, who said it, at a time when there are righteous people in the generation, the righteous are seized, i.e., they die or suffer for the sins of the generation. If there are no righteous people in the generation, school children who are also without sin are seized for the sins of the generation. Okay, so basically, it's either the leaders, the or the righteous ones, or if it's not, if there's not, if they don't exist, so then the people who will suffer are these children. Okay, whatever this means, we're not going to focus on this right now. Rabbi Yitzchak ben Ze'iri said, and some say Rabbi Shimon ben Nizira said, what is the verse that alludes to this? If you know not, you're fairest among women, go your way forth by the footsteps of the flock and feed your kids beside the shepherds' tents, Mishkanot. Okay, so this is from the Song of Songs. So when we say an explanation to this of this verse, they are the lambs that are taken as collateral, which is the etymology similar to the word Mishkanot, in place of the shepherds. So if the shepherds and leaders of the generation corrupt the multitudes, young children die because of their sins. With regard to the dilemma, conclude from it that Rabbi Elazar, son of Rabbi Yossi, said that the illness of a sakura also results from slander, as the breiter provides an additional cause of the illness. So this is here. So in the Gemara comments indeed conclude from it. So all this is to back and forth is to come out. Why do we get this disease? So it seems to be everybody. There's this idea of slander as a play. Rabbi Shimon had this idea that it's the lack of the dereliction of study of Torah. Fine. So now, in this story, it all started that Rabbi Yehuda, when they were giving their opinions, Rabbi Yehuda was the head of the speakers. So now the Gemara takes that and goes off on this what we were trying to get to. In this Braita, Rabbi Yehuda is described as head of the speakers in every place. The Gemara asks, and why did they call him head of the speakers in every place? The Gemara relates that this resulted due to an incident that took place when Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon were sitting, and Rabbi Yehuda, son of converts, sat beside them. Rabbi Yehuda opened and said, "How pleasant are the actions of this nation," talking about the Romans, "as they establish marketplaces, establish bridges, and establish bathhouses." Rabbi Yossi was silent, and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai responded and said, "Everything they established only for their own purposes. They established marketplaces to place prostitutes in them, bathhouses to pamper themselves, and bridges to collect taxes from all who pass over them." Okay, so what do we have here? We're Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. Now, I told you before that Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon have this approach where they argue when it came to the law on Shabbos about whether or not when you do something that's and you cause an inadvertent desecration of Shabbos, are you responsible? So Rabbi Shimon says you're not responsible unless you had intent. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, your intent doesn't matter. So that if I cause something inadvertently, Rabbi Yehuda would say I'm responsible. And Shimon bar Yochai says that you are not liable unless you have intent. So your intent is what matters. So now bring that to this machloket, what they're having over here. Did the Romans, what the Romans did, the Romans built society. Would you say that the Romans are, you know, should be praised for that? So Rabbi Yehuda says, look at them, how fantastic they are. They opened, they established marketplaces, established bridges, established bathhouses. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai turns to him and says, everything they did had a poor intent. So I'm not impressed. Okay? He says they established them for prostitution, for pampering themselves, for collecting taxes. Rabbi Yehuda, the son of Ben-Gerim, went and related their statements to his household, and those statements continued to spread until they were heard by the monarchy. So what do you think happens? Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is going to be in trouble. He criticized the Romans. They ruled and said, Yehuda, who elevated the Roman regime, shall be elevated and appointed as head of the sages, the head of the speakers in every place. Yossi, who remained silent, shall be exiled from his home in Judea as punishment and sent to the city of Tzipori in the Galilee. and Shimon, who denounced the government, shall be killed. Okay, so our Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is in trouble now. He's got the Romans running after him. So what happens? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son, Rabbi Elazar, went and hid in the study hall. Every day, Rabbi Shimon's wife would bring them bread and a jug of water, and they would eat. When the decree intensified, Rabbi Shimon said to his son, "Women are easily impressible, and therefore there is room for concern lest the authorities torture her and she reveal our whereabouts." They went and they hid in a cave. A miracle occurred, and a carob tree was created for them, as well as a spring of water. They would remove their clothes and sit covered in it and in sand up to their necks. They would study Torah all day in that manner. At the time of prayer, they would dress, cover themselves, and pray, and they would again remove their clothes afterwards so that they would not become tattered. They sat in the cave for 12 years. Elijah the prophet came and stood at the entrance to the cave and said, "Who will inform Bar Yochai that the emperor died and his decree has been abrogated?" Okay? So here you have the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Shimon, who end up having to go into hiding for 12 years they sat in hiding, and it's explained that this is where Rabbi Shimon and his son studied the secrets of Torah, and that the whole Kabbalistic tradition is going to come from this story here. Now what happens? They emerged from the cave and saw people who were plowing and sowing. So you have to imagine, here they are. They basically have left normal life for this long period of time. And so they've become completely focused on the spiritual realm. And they really have, like, you know, as much as a human being can exit that physicality of life, they've done so. So they come out of the cave and they see people doing the normal things, where plowing and sowing. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, "These people abandon eternal life of Torah and study and engage in temporal life for their own sustenance." The Gemara relates that every place that Rabbi Shimon and his son Rabbi Elazar directed their eyes was immediately burned. A divine voice emerged and said to them, "Did you emerge from the cave in order to destroy my world? Return to the cave. Return to your cave." They again went and sat there for 12 months. They said, "The judgment of the wicked in Gehenna lasts for 12 months. Surely their sin was atoned in that time." A divine voice emerged and said to them, "Emerge from your cave." They emerged. Now, everywhere that Rabbi Elazar would strike, Rabbi Shimon would heal. Rabbi Shimon said to Rabbi Elazar, "My son, you and I suffice to the entire world, as the two of us are engaged in the proper study of Torah." Okay? So now, okay, let's finish the story. So as the sun was setting on Shabbat Eve, they saw an elderly man who was holding two bundles of myrtle branches and running at twilight. They said to him, why do you have these?" He said to them, "In honor of Shabbat." They said to him, let one suffice." He answered them, "One is corresponding to remember the Shabbat day and keep it holy, and one is corresponding to observe the Shabbat day and keep it holy." Rabbi Shimon said to his son, "See how beloved the mitzvot are to Israel. Their minds were put at ease, and they were no longer as upset that people were not engaged in Torah study." Okay? So just at this point, in terms of what happened here, so you have Rabbi Shimon and his son. They're quote-unquote locked away in the cave for 12 years. Now, what's interesting is they explain that this really parallels Rabbi Akiva's life. Rabbi Akiva, again, is the teacher of Rabbi Shimon. So now, Rabbi Akiva's life was that he went for 12 years and studied, amassed 12,000 students, came home to his wife, only to hear her say, "I would be happy if my husband asked me to leave to study for 12 more years, I would be happy for him to do that." And he left and went back for another 12 years, and that's when he amassed his full 24,000 students. So you have this parallel between Rabbi Shimon's life and Rabbi Akiva, his teacher, of 12 and 12. And here you have his going into, like, kind of like leaving this place, this world, to kind of enter this realm of the hidden, and then not being able to truly integrate that when he comes out of the cave that first time. There's a lack of integration. Therefore, sent back for that additional 12 months, which equals, like, in our parallel of Rabbi Kiva's life, the 12 years. But then when they come out this time, Rabbi Shimon himself has the ability to understand how things integrate. His son's still burning people, still not getting it, but Rabbi Shimon has the ability to soften that and to bring, you know, wherever his son would look, he would counteract it. And then when they see this older man running with his, right here, when you see this idea of this man running with the myrtle branches and having two bundles and showing this idea of the two elements of that there's this idea of Zachor and Shamor, like the positive and the negative within Shabbos of remember and also to keep, then they saw these two ideas that there's this balance. They were very much appeased by that. Now, just as a side to finish up the story, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, Rabbi Shimon's son-in-law, heard and went out to greet them. He brought him into the bathhouse and began tending to his flesh. He saw that Rabbi Shimon had cracks in the skin of his body. He was crying, and the tears fell from his eyes and caused Rabbi Shimon pain because the tears hit the open, you know, these wounds that he had in his skin. Rabbi Pinchas said to Rabbi Shimon, his father-in-law, "Woe is me that I have seen you like this." Rabbi Shimon said to him, "Happy are you that you have seen me like this, as had you not seen me like this, you would not have found in me this prominence in Torah." As the Gemara relates, at first, when Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai would raise a difficulty, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair would respond to his question with 12 answers. Ultimately, when Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair would raise a difficulty, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai would respond with 24 answers. So basically, as this 12-year period of Rabbi Shimon being away, his ability or his abilities in Torah had become so much more advanced. Rabbi Shimon said, "Since a miracle transpired for me, I will go and repair something for the sake of others in gratitude for God's kindness, as it is written, 'And Jacob came whole to the city of Shechem,' which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram, and he graced the continents of the city." Rav said, the meaning of "and Jacob came whole" is whole in his body, whole in his money, whole in his Torah. And what did he do? So what did he do? "And he graced the continents of the city. He performed gracious acts to the benefit of the city." Rav said, "Jacob established a currency for them." And Shmuel said, "He established marketplaces for them." And Rabbi Yochanan said, "He established bathhouses for them." In any event, clearly one for whom a miracle transpires should perform an act of kindness for his neighbors as a sign of gratitude. He said, "Is there something that needs repair?" They said to him, "There is a place where there is uncertainty in regard to ritual impurity, and the priests are troubled by being forced to circumvent it, and it is prohibited for them to become ritually impure from contact with a corpse. There was suspicion, but no certainty, that a corpse was buried there. Therefore, they were unable to definitively determine its status." Rabbi Shimon said, "Is there a person who knows that there was a presumption of ritual impurity? Is there anyone who remembers a time when this place was not considered ritually impure, or that at least part of it was considered to be ritually impure?" And the elder said to him, "Here Ben Zakkai planted and cut the truma of lupins. In this marketplace, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, who himself was a priest, once planted lupines that were given to him as truma. On that basis, the conclusion can be drawn that it was definitely ritually pure. Rabbi Shimon, like Jacob, also did so and took steps to improve the city and examine the ground. Everywhere that the ground was hard, he pronounced it ritually pure, as there was certainly no corpse there, and every place that the ground was soft, he marked it, indicating that perhaps a corpse was buried there. In that way, he purified the marketplace so that even priests could walk through it." Okay, so I'll finish off this last piece. "And a certain elder said in ridicule and surprise, 'When Yochai purified the cemetery, Rabbi Shimon got angry and said to him, had you not been with us, and even had you been with us, and were not counted with us in rendering this ruling, what you say is fine. You could have said that you were unaware of my intentions, or that you did not disagree or participate in this decision. Now that you were with us and were counted with us in rendering this ruling, you will cause people to say that the sages are unwilling to cooperate with one another. They will say, if competing prostitutes will apply makeup to each other and help one another look beautiful, all the more so that Torah scholars should cooperate with each other. He directed his eyes towards him, and the elder died. Rabbi Shimon went out to the marketplace, and he saw Yehuda, son of Kamrutz, who was the cause of the entire incident. Rabbi Shimon said, this one still has a place in the world. He directed his eyes towards him and turned him into a pile of bones. So, like, this is the beginning. So the story starts with this Rabbi Yehuda, of the son of Kamrutz, or Yehuda ben Gerim, who caused all this trouble for Rabbi Shimon. And so, like, the story ends with that climax of him ultimately being punished for having done what he did by running to the authorities to tell about Rabbi Shimon's negative speech about the Romans. What's interesting about this story, just as a total story, is that the Gemara's context begins with talking about the issue of Lashon Hara in the Asakra story. And so you see that what goes through that the final, like, you know, like, the, if you're going to look at the storyline, one of the messages that's coming through here is that what people say is very, very powerful and has major impact. And I guess the bigger the person, the bigger that can potentially be in terms of what they say. So here you have Rabbi Shimon criticizing the Romans. If that would have stayed amongst them, everything would have been very different. But because this Yehuda ben Gerim went to tell on or to give away Rabbi Shimon, that this whole thing, this whole story ends up happening where Rabbi Shimon and his son go away for 12 years plus another year. He basically changes the trajectory of his life and really changes the trajectory of how we are going to relate to the hidden secrets of Torah. Because in the time period that he goes into this cave of the 12 plus 1 year, so you have these 13 years of where he completely, like, leaves, like, normal human existence. And what's interesting is what the Gemara is telling us, basically, when he comes out, he really does not have the ability to integrate that whatever he amassed, and all that knowledge and all that understanding that he was able to attain in those 13 years in the cave. He really had no ability to integrate that into normal everyday life. And then it's only after being sent back in that extra year, the message is clear that he needs to learn how to integrate it, and he then is able to integrate those lessons, those teachings. And so that becomes the basis of what we understand as the Zohar. What I just saw recently is that at the time of Lag BaOmer, that Rabbi Shimon, whatever writings he had put together, the publishing didn't occur until he passes away on Lag BaOmer, and that his student, it says the student's name was Rabbi Abba, that Rabbi Abba basically publishes all of these teachings on Lag BaOmer. So Lag BaOmer becomes this time of the celebration of the Torah, the hidden Torah. Okay, so now let's try. So that's all these things going on. So what does it have to do with us? How does it apply to where we're at this point? So one of the things that when you take a Zohar and you open it up, what you'll notice is, first of all, it takes the Torah, the written Torah, and it looks at the verses, and it analyzes those verses on a very takes it, let's put it this way, on a much deeper level. So, like, whatever we see on the surface, so the idea of Torah in the Hebrew is that it has multiple layers of meaning. And it comes along the Zohar, and it's not doing anything so crazy like that in terms of meaning. It's not like it's making up stuff. It's looking at the words of the Torah, and it's able to either read between the lines or the nuance, really the nuance of each word and the, you know, different contexts of things. And it's introduced to us incredible depths of Torah that maybe we were not sensitive to before that. What's interesting is that when today when you were to, if you were to take a course, let's study Chumash together, the five books, and you would open up, the first thing we'd always start with is Rashi. Rashi seems to be the go-to in terms of understanding like basic reading of Torah. And again, Torah, when I say Torah, I'm talking about the five books of Moses. But what's interesting is then you open up a Ramban, Nachmanides. So Rashi lives in the year 1000. You know, comes along Ramban, Nachmanides, in the late 1100s, 1200s, and his commentary on Torah, on Chumash, is going to look at Rashi, he'll look at Ibn Ezra, even Maimonides at times he'll make reference to, who all preceded him, but then he'll come up with a different looking, he'll have his own, you know, commentary based on a little bit of a different look. The way I would summarize it sometimes, on the simplest level, is that Rashi looked at a line. Let's say he had a verse. He looks at the verse. He's not necessarily looking at context as much. He's not focused on the bigger picture. Nachmanides came along and looked at the Torah's reading and said, he looked at it in a larger context to understand what the Torah is saying, even on that verse. But in the Nachmanides' writings, you'll see that he'll make reference to Kabbalistic ideas. So that his parish on Chumash, his explanation on Chumash, is going to now introduce more of a Kabbalistic bend, and that's coming from, you know, this the school of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Now the truth is, just to give it fair credit, where did Rabbi, you know, nothing, you see, what's interesting about Torah is that our Masorah, our tradition, nothing exists in a vacuum. It's not like the guy shows up one day and has his own, you know, commentary without some kind of someone who came before him. So it says that, you know, each one has a teacher that came before that gave over to them these traditions, and each person then takes it and puts their own personal, let's say not spin, but their personal contribution, let's just say, and then expands, brings it forward, enhances. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is coming as a student of Rabbi Akiva. We know about Rabbi Akiva that the way he studied Torah is that he saw the details. He was the one who analyzed every kotso shel, every crown that a word had in the Torah. Rabbi Akiva was able to analyze and see meaning in every crown, extra little crown on every word. So Rabbi Akiva was a detail person. It says, the Talmud tells us about that there was a Shimon ben Amsoni who would learn, who actually was able to derive meaning from every extra and in the Torah. Every time it said et, he was able to derive meaning from that extra word. Et, and this and means this, and this and means that. So the Talmud tells us that he was able to analyze every one of those extra ands in the Torah, which I never even counted, but must be endless. And he got stuck on one. He couldn't explain when it says, Et Hashem Elokecha Tira, you should fear God, and you should fear God. What is and? What is the and of and? You should fear God. Coming to expand upon what does it teach us? So he says there that he basically said, I cannot explain that one. I'm now going to have to scrap my whole approach, and literally scrapped his whole life's work because he could not crack that one. Comes along, I think it's Rabbi Akiva, and he says, I know what that means. The meaning of that was, it means to come and to include the rabbis, the Talmid Chachamim, the scholars. And so they asked the question, how did he figure that out? And his teacher, Shimon HaMsoni, couldn't figure it out. And they say because he had the ability to see this person's dedication to truth. Here he couldn't explain one. He had a flaw, one flaw in his system of approach. He was willing to scrap his whole life's work because it wasn't true. So it comes along the student and says, ah, you see, that's godly. a person's divine ability to be able to be so dedicated to truth that he's willing to throw out his whole life's work for one flaw in his system, that's godliness. That and et Hashem Elokecha tira, and you should fear God. The and is to include people who are on that level of divine inspiration, the Talmidei Chachamim. So, but this Rabbi Akiva was also very detailed. And so what happens is that perhaps we can explain what happened to the students of Rabbi Akiva. And again, I say these things with trepidation. These were big people, but clearly there was a flaw that was going on that caused the destruction of this group of this. I mean, you're talking about 24,000 students. It says that there were 12,000 pairs. So the flaw, though, was is that they were the nature of the study of that whole school of thought was that of detail. But if you get so caught up in the detail that sometimes you lose the ability to see the bigger picture, right? So it comes along and you see that Rabbi Shimon himself, when he goes into the cave for 12 years and comes out, they're so caught up in the detail that they were not able to see this bigger picture that there's something wrong, that the voice comes out and says, go back into the cave. You're not ready to be in society. And that after the 12 months of being back in the cave, the message of integration work was there. And so that part of like what could be the hidden, the call it the chiddush, this new idea of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's Zohar, the Kabbalistic approach, is the idea of integration. Like the ultimate thing is to really truly integrate the depths, the hidden secrets of Torah, is to see how everything is truly integrated, and that the need for it, to be able to strive for integration, and not to get caught up. So like there should be a balance. This idea of klal u prat u klal. Klal is the general, prat is the detail, and then klal is to go back to the general. But the idea of taking the detail and the general and to somehow be able to integrate those two is really the ultimate answer of what we strive for. So like during the Sphira period where there was this unfortunate, there's a certain type of scrutiny that's involved in the time period, like in the energy of the time period. And so here are the students, there was no leeway for their, issue of not of getting too caught up in the detail, to not see the bigger picture, and therefore to cast aspersions on each other, to be too, difficult with amongst themselves, that caused the decline. But that, and even Rabbi Shimon, we see that even post, he's one of the five students of Rabbi Kiva's second foray here, that even he's got that issue of how to integrate, how to be able to see the general with the detail. And so it comes along, and after he comes out, that at the end of this, he's able to figure it out. What's interesting is Pinchas Ben Yair, just as a side, so you know that, I don't know if you're familiar with the book Mesilat Yesharim. So it was written by Rav Lozato. It's a very the Path of the Just, if you've seen that book. So that's like a very famous, very well-known book. It's based on the teachings of Rav Pinchas Ben Yair, who is the son-in-law of Shimon Bar Yochai. So it's like we're talking about a lot of, these, in this story, you see these personalities. But this idea of what happened here, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Akiva, ultimately brings us to a Lag BaOmer of being able to see that this process of where we're looking now from, we're sitting back and watching, this is what happened. But this idea that there was this struggle, and it continues to be a struggle, this idea of how to integrate, and bring the Kedusha, the holiness, the sanctity into the everyday world. You take a Torah study and then integrate, you got people sitting and studying for years in the house of the Talmud and things of that nature, and then the struggle for them many times is how to bring that and integrate it into the regular everyday life. So that's something that it was a struggle there with Rabbi Shimon, and it's always a struggle for even today. But the idea of what's incredible about this Rabbi Shimon is that he was able to work through these things and come out and then reveal and show the depths of Torah in terms of how we can use that to understand God and his world, and also about what the purpose of where this world is going, like really getting that kind of messaging or understanding through what Rabbi Shimon revealed in his teachings. Any questions? Comments?
I mean, yeah, John, finish there. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, I just had a basic one. So why did he only have 5 students? Were they nervous about learning with him? Like what? When he restarted the second group?
It's not clear. Yeah. You know, it just says that he went to the south and ended up having these 5 students, but these 5 students were all superstars. Not to say that the 24,000 weren't, but yeah, just this is, it doesn't say why, it just says that's what it was. Like, could it be that they were under the gun? I mean, you see that Rabbi Shimon clearly had to run away and hide from the Romans, but not clear why only 5, or maybe just he understood, I don't need to have the numbers or not, I need the quality, not the quantity, who knows, I'm not sure. It's a good question.
He was also a lot older.
True.
It's one thing to do it when you're 40. It's another thing to do it when you're 80.
Yeah. No, it's not.
My point was that it's unbelievable. That, like, you're right. There are people who, you see people devoted their lives to studying Torah, but they can't function. You know, you realize it's great that you sit and study every minute of every day, but you've got responsibilities of daily life that have to be attended to. And it's almost like it's bad for the brand in some way. Like, you know, you see some people who are like waiting in the waiting area for the doctor's office, and you're seeing they're reading Torah and they're reading Gemara, and the kids are running around like, you know, whatever. And it's like it's a balance.
Right. So that's, you see, what's interesting is to be, you know, blatant, you know, to be very honest and to be, you know, yeah, it's not a simple thing. So you see, the Gemara is really saying also that there is this issue, a challenge of integration. It's not a simple thing. They always say, don't never judge Torah by the people. Right? It's like this is Torah. And then the question is that the people, I mean, there are amazing, amazing people that you can say, oh, wow, that's Torah. That's amazing. This person's like an ambassador of the highest quality. And then unfortunately, like in anything in life, you have the exceptions, or you have people who are not necessarily getting it right, and everything in between. So, but here we see this idea, there is a struggle of integration. It's not, when he comes out of the cave after 12 years, I mean, it's hard. I mean, how do you integrate, you know, that loftiness into the mundane reality that is? And so you see that there was an issue there, you know?
To me, it also speaks to relevancy. In other words, there's integration, but it also has to be relevant, right? You need to look at things, and it needs to be, when you're at that lofty level, it's one thing, but to someone like me, Torah also has to be relevant. It has to be relevant in my daily life, and it needs to be able to be applied in a relevant way, not only integrated, but relevant.
Right, okay. That's, I mean, I don't think I don't know if they were having issues of relevance as much as major integration issues, in terms of also, like, they got to, like, you know, you could be in a place where you're becoming so, and it's a good thing to, like, be able to experience, like, lofty spiritual plane, let's say, of, you know, being very in the zone, let's say, of being away from any of your physical needs. Let's say at Yom Kippur, you're, like, fasting, you're really, like, your head's clean, you're not being distracted, you're in a very high plane, and then you, something comes up that's very mundane. It's hard to, like, how do you integrate that? But it's something that, you know, that's the challenge, that there's a need to take these, like, things. Let's say, you know, having a spiritual experience and then taking that and kind of integrating into, like, your regular mundane life. It's not so simple. But that's a challenge. All right.
Like, how am I gonna integrate this morning's class into my regular day life now?
Right. Well, that's right. But there's definitely, I would say for us, knowing that there is a realm of loftiness, of spiritual loftiness that's there, is very important to be aware of that awareness, and to also to tap into that, to be able to realize that, you know, like one of the things, this is a very important idea. The Kabbalah is one of the things that it's trying to answer is how does the non-physical God, and when you say non-physical, I mean zero, there's no physicality to God whatsoever. How does that integrate with a physical world? That's kind of like where Shimon Bar Yochai is coming out of that cave. He's completely like negated his physicality, and he looks at the physical realm and he's like, how do I relate to this? Kabbalah is answering that question of how does God, who's completely non-physical, interact with this world? How does that work? So there's a whole system that goes to explain that based in the Ari. Ari comes later, and other people's other writings that really try to understand like how the you know, the unlimited God comes into the limited world, you know?
You know, Jonathan, on a very limited level, coming off of what both you and Lawrence has said, you know, I think about going on the men's trip and how focused I'm able to be in being in the moment and doing everything, you know, the right way and praying three times a day, and how much more difficult that is once I hit the, like, the bright lights in the big city and I'm back at home and I have my kids and I have my family and all those things, you know, while we are moving towards that and adding more, it's not the same level. So I feel in a certain way, it's like when you have the time to sit and focus, obviously a lesser version in the cave, it's much, much easier to delve deep and get caught up in those, you know, the nuances, you know, and I find obviously it's more of a challenge in life itself. So
yeah, but this is the same. It's the same. What you just described is exactly what you know. It's the same. It's the same idea. Different. You know, everybody has their own context of the challenge, right? So that's like what you're describing. For all of us on a different level is the same. But in Rav Shimon Bar Yochai was taking it on a much higher level, but also the same idea of how to take those, that inspiration, and to integrate into your daily grind, so to speak, or the when you hit the bright lights of the big city. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan, for another great class.
Beautiful day, everybody.
And so now when you come.
Yeah. And Jonathan, I will say that we do take some of the things that you know, that we go over here on a lofty level. I do think that, you know, we do begin to integrate them. So we, you know.
I don't think today was so out there. Today wasn't so out there. This was more like.
This was a good one.
As my friend likes to say, I should be telling stories more often. So this is more like, you know.
That's funny.
All right. Have a great day, guys. Great week. All the best.
Jonathan, just let Alana know that her birthday, which worked, and my